or starting a bit late. We had a connectivity problem here. We have to get used to the, what do they call it, the new normal of having meetings online. The meeting is officially open. You are all welcome. Welcome, honorable members. Welcome, stakeholders, the public who are here to make a presentation. And also welcome officials from Parliament. Let me not take much of your time. Are there apologies? Alan Tebo.
Apology from Mr. Hill Lewis.
Apologies from Hill Lewis. Is Zanele, Honorable Zanele Nkomo here? I was told that she's not well.
We haven't received any message from her, sir.
Yeah, she's not well. I think she was. I was told that she was even admitted at the hospital. We wish her a speedy recovery. And then let's proceed. And then we'll have, how many minutes have you allocated to each stakeholder, Sister Tebo?
15 minutes.
Okay.
1:05.
Okay. No, that's it. Members of the public, stakeholders, you are welcome. As Ms. Panya has indicated, you have 15 minutes to make a presentation. That is your submission. Make sure that you stick to 15 minutes. We do so because by 12 or so, members of this committee belong to other committees. They have to attend other meetings. So that's the reason why we are quite strict. We have received some of your presentations in a written form. So we'll plead that you speak to the presentation rather than read everything that is in the presentation. Kosato, are you ready? Is Kosato connected?
Good morning, Comrade Chair. Sorry, I just had the computer froze for a second. Yes, we're ready, Chairperson. So whenever it's good for the committee chair, we're ready to go.
Okay. You heard, Comrade Matthews, that the presentation should be 15 minutes, isn't it? Because we got a written submission. So we'll request that you speak to the slides rather than reading line by line, because the members of this committee have got other commitments after 12. So by 12, we have to adjourn the meeting. So let's start with Kosato. Okay. It's 20 past 9 now. So I hope that by 25 to, you will be done to 10. Comrade Mitten, over to you.
No, thanks very much, Comrade Chair. I'm sure I'll be done in less than 15 minutes. And I think, Comrade Chair, it also would just be appropriate for ourselves as COSATU just to offer our condolences and sympathies to the colleagues on the passing away of Comrade Dr. Dan Plakis over the weekend. I think it's a loss to all of us and to the nation. So Chair, just to, on the Auditing Profession Amendment Bill, I think we can just move to the next slide. So I think, Chair, it's a very critical bill from our side as COSATU. It's a bill that we support, and I think, Chair, it doesn't fall in an empty vacuum or empty context. It's a bill that's critical in the context of state capture, and of course the damage that has done to the state, to the economy, to the nation at large. And I think, Chair, we often have spoken and we've seen what has been the role of auditors generally in state capture, both from the public and the private sector. We feel the bill is useful, Chair, in addressing some gaps in the legislation And we think also towards strengthening the oversight capacity of IRBA. So we support the bill, but we do feel, Chairperson, that there are some weaknesses in the bill that we'd hope the committee will be able to help strengthen. And we made 3 proposed amendments in that regard. But I think largely, Chair, we must amend the bill, we must fast track it, and we must pass it. Next slide. So, Chair, I think just again to give context that this bill is not a normal bill and we're not in a normal era. If you look at the AG reports every year across the state, the SOEs, the municipalities, we see the horror stories year after year that on average we lose about 10% of our budget or about 150 billion rand at the least through to corruption and wasteful expenditure. We've seen the collapse of good governance in many, many SOEs, departments and municipalities. Some of them are even collapsing, as we know. And of course, Chair, this has a devastating impact upon the state, its capacity to deliver essential public services, the fiscus, and of course, upon workers in both the public and private sector. Now, workers in the public sector have been denied the wage increases because of the failure of auditors to do what they are paid to do. And I think, Chair, we're not just coming with slogans. We've seen this in the many commissions of inquiry into state capture. Auditors were not only complicit, but in fact often facilitated state capture and corruption and whitewashed it with no consequences, Chair. We have yet to see one auditor go to prison. I think with Eskom, at least they managed to take back some of the money. But beyond that, it looks like they've been treated with kid gloves, to be honest. Next slide. So, Chair, I think we support the provisions in the bill. We agree with the criteria that if you want to serve an IRBA, you cannot be a practicing auditor. I think this helps to avoid conflicts of interest. We fully support the provisions to capacitate IRBA to conduct search and seizure operations of auditing firms. These are bold. They are needed to tackle complicit auditors. We will not want to see them being watered down in any way. Next slide. Chair, we also support, and we think they are logical, the provisions to capacitate IRBA to conduct disciplinary procedures, again, to deal with delinquent auditors. And again, Chair, we think that the sanctions provisions are welcome, in particular the provisions to deregister auditors from practicing. And again, we need to start using the tools of the law to deal with delinquents who are really running amok in society. Next slide. So our proposed amendments, Chair, are 3. The first one is on page 3 of the bill, that's clause 5.5, which basically reduces the number of required meetings by law of IRBA from 4 to 2 a year. We can't understand the logic of that, Chair. 4 meetings as a minimum is not excessive. It's not cumbersome or onerous to IRBA. More so, Comrade Chair, when we have the capacity to conduct virtual meetings these days. So you don't even have a cost or a logistical implication for having meetings. But Chair, again, we're looking at the context of state capture and the need to clean up the state and the need to deal with errant auditors. So we can't understand why would you then reduce the obligatory required meetings from 4, a very small amount in itself, to 2. IRBA is a critical institution in dealing with the cleanup of the state. This we feel, Chair, is very reckless. It sends a wrong message. We think it actually will disrupt and weaken the work of IRBA. So our proposal there, Chairperson, is simply to delete that clause, which provides for reduction by half of the required meetings. We should stick with the 4 meetings a year and not backtrack on it. Next slide. Our second proposed amendment, Chair, is on the search and seizure operations. In clause 7E, which is on page 8. And the search and seizure operations provisions are fine, but there's one slight anomaly there where it says search and seizure operations of auditing firms must be conducted during normal office hours. We couldn't understand the logic of that, Comrade Chair. When you're dealing with criminals, there's no need for diplomacy. I'm not aware of SAPs or other law enforcement organs of the state being restricted to only doing search and seizure during office hours. The logic then says that if someone is tipped off, as they often would be tipped off about a search and seizure, they will simply deny the audit, the IRBA to come after 5 o'clock at night or on the weekends. It will give them a free card to then to clean up, to destroy whatever incriminating documents exist after hours. We all know that police search and arrest people at 4 o'clock in the morning. So we're not sure why we want to tie the hands of Irba behind his back. So again, Chair, a proposal here is simply to delete the reference to normal office hours. Capacitate Irba to do search and seizure 24/7 as the need arises. Next slide, Chair. The last proposal from our side, Comrade Chair, is a new provision in the bill that we're proposing. Irba does have an in-house rule requiring the mandatory rotation of auditing firms after every 10 years to avoid an incestuous, complicit relationship developing between auditing firms who have these perpetual contracts with companies. So Irba has a rule informally for 10 years. We think there's a need to, one, to make it a legislative requirement, Comrade Chair. It shouldn't be simply an informal rule. It should be a requirement of law. The King's report speaks to this such requirements. This is a major gap where you have a direct profit relationship between the auditors and the companies, where auditors are afraid to rock the boat. They know if they rock the boat, if they expose the skeletons, they can lose out on these evergreen contracts. So our proposal, Comrade Chair, is two. One is to make this a requirement of the law, so to insert it in the bill that there must be mandatory rotation auditing firms. Second, Chair, is that we feel the 10-year provision itself is too generous. It, in fact, should be 5 years. 10 years, you can have a lot of damage. We've seen that what happened in the last 10 years in South Africa, where state capture ran amok. So that's our proposal, Chair. Have the new provision, require mandatory rotation after every 5 years. Next slide. So in conclusion, Chair, we feel this is a welcome and a progressive bill. It's long overdue until we start dealing with some of the white-collar crime we've seen amongst auditors. They really need to pay the price in terms of what they've allowed to happen to the state and to the economy. So we support the bill, Chair. We do feel it needs to be passed by Parliament as quickly as possible. But we do feel, Chair, that our three proposed amendments should be considered by the committee in terms of retaining the frequency of our meetings of 4 years per the existing act, to remove the normal office hours limitation for search and seizure, and I think most critically, Chair, to require the compulsory or mandatory automatic rotation of auditing firms every 5 years. But yeah, let me stop there, Comrade Chair, and I hope I've kept to the time frame. Thanks very much, Chair and members.
Thanks very much, Comrade Matthews. We have only used almost 9 minutes instead of 15. Thanks very much. And thanks very much for reminding us about the passing on of Professor Plakis. Professor Daniel Plakis was the chairperson of the Fiscal and Financial Commission, I mean FFC. And also, let's acknowledge that we have received the message of the passing on of Comrade Priscilla Jana. Comrade Priscilla Jana was an anti-apartheid and a human rights lawyer. Can we observe a moment of silence for a minute? May the souls of Professor Daniel Plakis and Priscilla Jana rest in peace. I thank you. Thanks, colleagues. Let's move to the next stakeholder, Open Secrets Organizations. You have got 15 minutes from 9:30 to 9:45. Over to you.
Good morning. I'm Mamelo Nsiana from Open Secrets, and I'll be presenting with my colleague, Michael Marchant, Open Secrets is a non-profit organization. We're based in Cape Town, and we focus on private sector economic crime as it relates to human rights abuses. We use advocacy, the law, and investigations to hold the private sector to account. In our submission, we use evidence from a report released earlier this year, the Corporations and Economic Crime Report, the auditors, and it focused in particular on the big four auditors, EY, Deloitte, KPMG, PwC, EY. Yeah, sorry, I think I already said that. We look at how they played a role in economic crime and financial crime at BBS, Steinhoff and Tongaat, and state capture at SAA, SARS, ESCOM, and Estina. We really want to highlight today that auditing is a social function, and it serves a social utility, and it is in the public interest, which is why we view the role of Open Secrets in this meeting as very important. We view ourselves as an important stakeholder, and it's important to continue to include the civil society organizations in these kinds of meetings, especially audit reform, because of the huge role it plays in ensuring public interest and public trust in private entities and public entities, and the huge costs that we've seen to public sector entities, which have been incurred the cost of audit failure by particularly the big four, and in some cases their accomplices, which are much smaller. And this is why we want to place our submission in particular in the context of it being something that is about the public interest and about the social utility. We want to emphasize that in our submission. And Michael Marchand, my colleague, will go further into how we do that. And we'll also emphasize the role of auditors in global economic crime, and the fact that this is something that is very important globally right now. This is an industry that is considered in crisis, and this bill comes at a time at which everyone in the world quite literally is discussing the reform of the industry. Therefore, we really support the bill, even though we've identified some gaps and recommendations from which we'd like to add on to it. But we do think that this is pertinent and something that should be taken seriously in the moment right now. We support also COSATU's recommendations, and we'd like to further add to that, and we view them also as an important stakeholder in this discussion. Another thing that we'll be discussing in our submission, or that is covered in our submission, is the impact on the public generally by audit failure. I think we saw that by the loss to the pension funds of the government employees pension fund. We saw that at Steinhoff and at Tongaat Hewlett with the loss of jobs. The failure of auditors to spot those irregularities really has a huge financial cost on the economy and also on the public. So it is important that auditing is, again, firmly placed as a public interest issue and not a private sector issue, and that this is not something that is continue to be something that is about profit margins. The next thing that we'll be focusing on in our submission is the importance of the bill in general, and we locate this within the international discussions on the audit industry and why we view the audit industry to be in crisis. And then lastly, we'll touch a little bit on the gaps and recommendations made in our submission. I'll pass over now to my colleague, Michael Martins.
Thanks very much, Mamelo. And just to echo Mamelo's thanks to the chair and to the members of the committee for allowing us the opportunity to address you this morning. As directed by the chair, I'm going to do my best not to read from our written submission, because that is available to the members. But rather, what I'll try and do in the time available is to try and group both the things we think are good about the amendment bill, what it brings to the regulatory framework that is currently missing, and then also try and group the recommendations that we have about where we think the amendment bill can be strengthened, and then finally just to touch on a few things that we think could be included in the amendment bill that are not currently either in that bill or the Act. But maybe just to kind of provide the context from which we base our recommendations, you know, Mamelo's already spoken about, the comrade from COSATU has already spoken about the context in which we come to this, the large corporate failures of places like Steinhoff, the failure of large audit firms at public entities like South African Airways and others, and the huge public costs that brings to us. And I think what our research shows and the evidence from South Africa and around the world shows that audit failure can really be explained with reference to a few central weaknesses in the industry. The first one is often the lack of independence between the regulatory bodies and the auditing industry itself and the revolving doors between those places. The second one is the insufficient ability of the regulatory board to impose effective sanctions and powerful sanctions that are actually a deterrent on audit firms. Linked to that are the insufficient powers of investigation for the regulatory board. And then the final one, and this is something that I will return to several times in the recommendations, is around access to information for the public and transparency, both from the firms themselves, but then also from the side of the regulatory board. And so based on those concerns, we are very supportive of a few of the provisions in the amendment bill. And just briefly to mention them, we think that the way it removes some of the conflicts of interest on the appointments of the board, particularly by reducing the role of registered auditors on that board, is a hugely beneficial point. We think the new powers of investigation, including those of search and seizure, subpoena and search, are absolutely vital and should not be removed. What we will get to, however, is we think that some of those new powers of investigation might be undermined by insufficient provision of sanction to back those up. We also support the creation of the Enforcement Committee, the provision for the referral of non-audit matters for investigation to related bodies, and the provision for additional offences. But mindful of time, I'd just like to group our comments on the amendment bill into a few central issues that I'd like to raise. The first one is around the appointment processes for the board. The second one is around the release of findings of investigations into improper conduct. The third are secrecy in public hearings. The fourth would be sanctions, and this is something that I'm going to try and stress as much as I can. And the final one would be disclosure of information. And so to start on the issue of the appointment of the board, as I've said, we support the removal of some of the conflicts of interest from having a board filled with registered auditors that have a close tie to the industry itself. However, there's a few things that I think could be added here. The first one is that the Act and the Amendment Bill does not require the minister to consider when appointing a member of the board any allegations of impropriety, including corruption, fraud, and or any dishonesty, and whether that particular candidate has a conflict of interest. We see no reason why that should not be explicitly included in the provision, which would be Section 11, which would just require and enjoin the minister to consider some of those things before making or before the board makes any appointments. We would also add that there should be greater transparency in terms of the information in the appointment process as it's provided to the public. And so we would advocate for an inclusion of information like the qualifications and curriculum vitae of any member appointed to the board, which should be given to the public. So in that regards some of the changes that could be made to the appointments for the board. Then moving on to the issue of the release of findings of investigation into improper conduct, which would be Section 48(7) of the Act, we would really advocate for the inclusion of a sentence at the end there that makes it mandatory to make any findings from IRBA into improper conduct fully available to the public. We've already seen on more than one occasion IRBA making a very serious finding. For example, just to give an example to the committee, the finding that PwC failed to report on contraventions of legislation and reportable irregularities at SAA. However, when IRBA made that very serious finding, it initially refused to release the identity of the audit firm to the public. And we think this is anathema to, first of all, the constitutional right to access to information, but also the entire purpose of an investigation and a sanction of that nature should include public knowledge of the audit firm, what it's done, and the finding against it. And so a specific inclusion of that requirement, I think, would be very powerful. Regarding the actual disciplinary processes, we recognize that Section 50 does need to provide for occasions when those hearings might need to be made in camera. However, we again would require the Act or the Amendment Bill to include a mandatory requirement for OBA to explain why that decision has been made, to ensure that processes aren't being held behind closed doors without sufficient reasons denying the public access. Moving on to the issue of sanctions, we think that this is probably one of the most fundamental areas of the Amendment Bill that doesn't go far enough, and we draw the committee's attention both to Section 51(1), which refers to admissions of guilt, but also to provisions in 51(3), which refer to broader than that, so sanctions imposed after disciplinary hearings. And there's a couple of things to flag here. The first is that we don't think that a caution or reprimand as provided in the Act is ever an appropriate sanction for dishonest and or unethical behavior, even when a registered auditor or firm makes an admission of guilt. And the reason for this is that if you add to that the fact that the fines are not sufficiently high enough to deter conduct, we can find ourselves in a position where these firms repeatedly engage in conduct that doesn't match the lawful requirements of an auditor, and yet they're getting a slap on the wrists at the point at which they're supposed to receive sanction. And so we would see that as a problem. We'd also say that the current limit on fines as stipulated by the minister as per the Act of 200,000 rand is completely inadequate. As Marmelo spoke about in the introduction, fines need to be, first of all, more commensurate with the amount of money that the audit firms make out of these contracts, but they also need to be more commensurate with the harm felt by the public. So if there is a multi-billion rand loss to the public, either through a pension fund or through a failure of an audit at a public entity, and it is found that the registered auditor has failed in their lawful duties there, a fine of 200,000 rand is completely insufficient. And so we would really urge the committee to consider amendments here that could make the fine more in line with the harm that is suffered. Some of the ways in which to do this are to calculate a fine that is linked more firmly to the audit firm itself and to various provisions in terms of how much money they've made from that contract, or things like revenue and turnover, which is the approach taken by the Competition Commission, for example. And the alternative as well, instead of only having a maximum fine, also having things like a minimum sanction for more serious infringements, and to define those serious infringements early on in the Act, to remove the discretion to provide cautions or reprimands for serious offences, and also to ensure urge a provision that more explicitly targets the audit firms themselves. What we've often seen in audit failure is that the registered auditor as an individual is targeted, and yet there's extensive evidence of a systemic failure on the part of the firm to provide a control environment in which that auditor is held to account and which other auditors in the team can raise those concerns. And so we think that would be a vital addition. And then finally, and this goes back to the transparency and disclosure of information in terms of Section 57A of the Amendment Bill, which allows for the exposure of information by anyone fulfilling a function in terms of the Act, would really urge the committee to consider an addition specifically that demands disclosure where disclosure is in the public interest. We feel that in totality, the Act does not always clearly enough require the Act and those acting in terms of the Act to act in terms of Section 32 of the Constitution and PIA in terms of our right to access information, and so that could be included more broadly. I realize, Chair, that I think if I'm correct, I have 1 minute left, so I will not go into detail about some of the gaps that we have identified in the Act, except to point to the committee to pages 8 and 9 of our submission, and maybe to summarize that those suggestions, like our suggestions on the Amendment Bill, really speak to those central ideas about greater sanctions, greater transparency and information, and greater independence for the board. So once again, thank you, Chair, and to the committee for hearing us today. And we would also welcome any questions Marmelo or I, both in this hearing and in future in writing, if we can assist the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Open Secrets Organization, for your submission. We'll deliberate and ask you questions towards the end of the program. Thanks. Let me invite Ernest and Young to make their presentation. 15 minutes, so it's from now until 10 o'clock. Over to you, Ernest and Young.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to you, the Chair, and the committee. Chair, I'm trying to get my video to switch on. It is not permitting me. However, I can start. Chair, firstly, thank you for the opportunity to make this oral presentation this morning. We do recognize that given the limited time, we cannot go through our entire submission. However, I think we want to start by firstly saying to you, the Chair, and the committee and the public in general, that we recognize our public interest role. And for that reason, we are in support in general on the provisions that are contained in the bill. However, Chair, we believe that it is important to ensure that this is balanced and it's fair. We recognize the profession that it needs to regain its position of public trust. And this is not just an issue in South Africa, but globally. And a lot has got to be done by the profession, working with regulators and the broader members of the financial reporting ecosystem to make sure that we are acting with integrity at all times. We are in support of the bill, and we want to, however, make mention on areas that we believe that the bill can achieve better fairness and balance to make sure that the rights of the auditors are also protected. We believe that is very important. If I can ask that we move to the second slide. Chair, I've already alluded to the our view as EY. What I do want to draw attention to, and this is part of our oral presentation, is Section 48A and B, which deals with the powers to enter and search premises and warrants. We do understand the need for the regulator to have unrestricted access to information to be able to achieve its mandate, and we support that. As I said, that needs to be achieved in a manner that ensures that the rights of the auditors are also protected. In that regard, Chair, I'd like to deal with a few points that are contained in 48A and 48B that we find problematic and that we require and ask that these are reconsidered. The first one that I'd like to begin with, Chair, is 48B1, which deals with the issue of a warrant for contravention of the Act. What we note from the bill in its current form, Chair, is that it speaks to the contravention of the Act or any part of the Act. We believe that this casts a wide net without due regard to whether the contravention is material or trivial. We believe that this can be further qualified to indicate that the issuing of a warrant or the application for the issuing of a warrant must be in instances where it is determined that there has been a material contravention of the Act. We believe that is important so that the net is not cast so wide that any trivial contravention of the Act then provides or gives powers for the regulator to obtain a warrant. And this is around the issue of balance, Chair. We believe that it must be balanced in terms of its application. The second one that I'd like to draw attention to, Chair, is the issue of last resort. In its current form, the bill as it's written, it does not indicate whether the regulator will be using its current available instruments and powers to obtain information which are already there. Before going the route of applying for a warrant. In fact, we believe that this seems to be a bar that is much lower than what we see as the powers available to the SATs as well through the Criminal Procedures Act, which requires that before a warrant can be obtained, there has got to be reasonable grounds for the warrant to be obtained. So we do not see that being included in the Act. And the reason for that, Chair, why it's so important, it is because this is to protect the rights to privacy in terms of Section 14 of the Constitution of the Republic. And we believe that that should be applicable to us as auditors as well, that we are not held to constitutionally to a standard that is much higher than that of the rest of the people of South Africa. So, Chair, we submit that Section 48B in its current form also does not provide clear direction for the courts, nor does it give guidance in terms of offences that would justify for a warrant to be issued. As it's written, a judge does not enjoy any guidance to determine whether the issuing of the warrant itself is justified, and then we referred to the issue of material versus trivial contraventions. So, Chair, not to take too long, given that we do not have a lot of time. We do believe that what could also be helpful is that the Act includes timelines for information to be submitted. And by the way, this could actually form a basis for the issuing of the warrant where the timelines have not been met by an auditor. This can actually be used as a basis for the obtaining of the warrant, as opposed to the basis being currently, from what we see, being an open-ended a basis that doesn't seem to be balanced. The last point I'd like to make, Chair, is around the right of appeal. And this could arise in many instances, such as the incorrect execution of the warrant, where we do not see an ability for the auditors to be able to appeal anything. We do believe that in the interest of being balanced and fair, this should be provided for in the APA. So, Chair, I'd like to leave it there. As I said previously, we do support the intent, the spirit of the bill. We do, however, need to make sure that as we take these steps to try and strengthen the profession, strengthen the regulator, we do not create a situation where there is an unfair treatment of the audit professionals in reaction to the challenges that we've had. We only seek to ensure that the bill is strengthened, that it's sustainable for future generations as well. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ntswane from Ernst & Young, and for being precise and straight to the point. Thanks very much. Now, I would like to give the opportunity to Deloitte to make their presentation. Deloitte, over to you.
Chairperson, Honourable Mr. Maswanganyi, Honourable Members of the Standing Committee on Finance and stakeholders in this public hearing, I'm Carla Budriks, Regulatory Lead, Deloitte Africa in South Africa. We thank you for the opportunity to present our submission in Parliament this morning on the proposed amendments to the Auditing Profession Act 2005. Deloitte fully supports regulatory reform in the auditing profession. Can I just ask that you share my presentation on the screen, please? Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. We are in agreement with amendments that are aimed to accelerate and improve the IRBA processes conducive to regulatory reform. Our comments and concerns on Bill 2 of 2020 are articulated to assist the IRBA in its objectives to provide regulatory oversight of auditors. Deloitte submitted its verbal comments to Parliament in February 2019 on substantially the same bill that is currently the subject of this hearing. Some engagement took place after the hearings, but the process seemed to have stalled and feedback on our proposals during the hearings of 2019 are yet to be received. It is with great expectation we appear here today in the hope that the much needed engagement will move forward, as it's not only in the interest of the IRBA and the audit profession, but first and foremost in the public interest. Although the bill is substantially the same, the environment is vastly different. There have been developments globally in the UK, in the profession, but also on the continent of Africa, and particularly in Nigeria, where we've seen the green shoots of much needed reform in the profession, where, for example, the Financial Reporting Council is in a process of expanding the regulatory financial reporting landscape to also include not only auditors, but also the preparers of financial statements, being mostly accountants in business and practice, audit committees, and those charged with governance, being management of business, and other assurance providers, being internal audit. We submitted our comments on the matters of principle that I will briefly deal with here today, informed by our very detailed annexures, including research on the topic of search and entry. Our comments were prepared through a lens of fair and just processes enshrined in our constitution. Democracy is founded on democratic values, accountability and openness, and the rule of law. Bill 2 of 2020 is found wanting in this regard on aspects of fair and just process for all participants in the process. I will highlight the deficiencies regarding transparency in the construct of the law, overcorrection of vast powers without balancing with concomitant remedies, a delegation of power arguably without the necessary authority and protections. I will also highlight parliamentary precedent on the topic of search and entry, where it is previously deliberated extensively on the topic in at least three laws now passed. It obtained two senior counsel opinions and the Constitutional Court gave judgment on this aspect. Moving to the matters of principle, we respectfully wish to bring the following matters to the attention of the committee. Slide 3, please. We support the strengthening of the powers of the IRBA to conduct much needed, effective, expeditious investigations and disciplinary proceedings. The amendments unfortunately result in a procedural and constitutional imbalance for the auditor that can be rectified by the introduction of a concomitant protection, such as an appeal process to our courts. This is a common feature in our law and particularly other legislation of other professions, such as the engineering profession, the health and legal professions, and contained in the recently deliberated Property Practitioners Bill. The latter was comprehensively deliberated and designed to correct procedural and constitutional imbalance that we have seen opined by in our Constitutional Court. We submit that Parliament should not deviate from this precedent. We propose that balance in the construct of the law can be achieved by introducing an appeal process to our courts for auditors. Slide 4, please. A comprehensive review and complete rewrite is needed on the consistency in which the IRBA board committee structure, processes and composition are legislated. The current construct of the Act is not conducive to a transparent, expeditious and effective process. Amendments are proposed to the IRB board committee, such as the Disciplinary Committee and Investigating Committee. The bill goes further in introducing the Enforcement Committee, which is presumably the structure currently referred to in the IRBA rules as the Disciplinary Advisory Committee. The committee's composition, duties, functioning and other items are inconsistently spread throughout the main Act. Regulations, rules and inaccessible delegations contained in board resolutions. the Enforcement Committee should be treated similarly to the other statutory committees in the Act, and its function should be more clearly articulated. It should not be a subcommittee. For the sake of regulatory certainty and consistent drafting, all statutory committees should have dedicated sections in the Act setting out their composition and functions, akin to the current sections 21 and 22 dealing with the committees for ethics and auditing standards. All procedural aspects must be set out in the regulations to the Act. The current amendment process provides an ideal opportunity to ensure consistency and transparency in the way the IRBA governance framework and different enforcement processes are set out. It is our recommendation that a complete review is needed to ensure that committees are comprehensively dealt with in the Act and that all procedural matters are transparently set out in the regulations. Unfortunately, Bill 2 of 2020 constitutes a reactive plug-and-play approach instead of addressing the matters that will improve and expedite governance and processes. Slide 5, please. The proposed amendment to Section 11 suggests that only formally registered auditors may be appointed to the board of the IRBA. The current proposal is to remove the inclusion of registered auditors from the board composition. This proposal is inconsistent with the approach followed by other professions in South Africa, such as the Legal Practices Council, the Health Professions Council, and the Engineering Council of South Africa, where there is significant representation of professionals in that profession. Imagine a Health Professions Council without doctors during the COVID pandemic. The auditing profession is complex. A thorough understanding and deep knowledge of auditing standards coupled with practical application and experience is needed. For the board of the IRBA to stay abreast of practical and professional development, it's imperative that registered auditors are appointed to the board. Registered auditors can contribute a wealth of knowledge, skill, and experience to the board of the IRBA and greatly enhance its governance. The appointment of registered auditors to the board of the IRBA shows confidence and encouragement to the IRB's own constituency and population. Contrary to the requirements of the Act, the board of the IRBA currently has for some time now lacked registered auditors in its composition, which may have potentially exacerbated the challenges facing the auditing profession. Slide 6, please. The bill seeks to diminish legal and auditing expertise applied to both the investigations and disciplinary committees. Although the bill prima facie appears to be an improvement of the processes, the legal and auditing specialists form a minority in the committee structures. While we support an improved and expeditious process, a lack of legal and audit expertise may have the opposite result. We propose that the proportion of persons with such expertise on the structures be increased as suggested in the detailed comments submitted. We further propose that the requirement for a retired judge or senior advocate as chairperson of the disciplinary committee be retained as legal expertise are much needed in complicated matters. Slide 7, please. The bill sets no monetary limit for the setting by the minister of the maximum fine that may be imposed in the proposed section 51B2. We propose that a maximum be placed on the limit that the minister may determine. This would be similar to the approach adopted in other pieces of legislation, such as section 71 of the National Credit Act or section 74(1) of the Competition Act. We submit that this power to allow unlimited sanctions may serve as a deterrent for entry and continued service in the profession. Smaller firms and individual auditors may not have the financial means or desire to remain in such a highly regulated profession with unlimited liability and no recourse, such as an appeal process consistent with other professions. Slide 8, please. The amendment of Section 48 provides that the IRBA may refer a non-audit matter brought against a registered auditor to the relevant accredited professional body for investigation and disciplinary proceedings. The South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, or SAICA, is currently the accredited body to which the proceedings will be referred. It is arguable whether the IRBA is an organ of state and subject to the promotion of the Administrative Justice Act 3 of 2000, or PAJA as we know it, has the authority and legal power to outsource its powers under the APA to a voluntary membership association such as SAICA. SAICA is not subject to the APA or the PAJA, and participants in the proceedings will not be afforded the protection of Section 57 of the APA and PAJA. The amendments do not stipulate what would constitute a non-audit matter, nor does it stipulate the proceedings that will apply to the accused. We propose that these matters be addressed to ensure a fair and just administrative process. These comments should also be viewed in the context of the absence of an impact assessment being conducted on Bill 2 of 2020. Slide 9, please. We have submitted substantial comments on the topic of search and seizure in Annex C of our submission. The IRBA has existing powers to obtain information from auditors comparable to the regulators of other professions such as lawyers, doctors and engineers. Currently, Section 47 of the APA gives the IRBA or any person authorised by it the power to inspect or review the practice of an auditor at any time. The power to request and inspect information is similar to the provisions of inter alia the Legal Practices Act 28 of 2014, the Engineering Profession Act 46 of 2000 and the Health Professions Act 56 of 1974. Given the existing powers in the APA, it is our contention that the additional entry and search provisions in the bill are unnecessary. If it is nevertheless believed that the IRB's powers must be extended, it should be done in a manner that is constitutionally balanced with due regard to Section 32 and 57 of the APA and Section 34 of the Constitution of South Africa. The introduction of such invasive procedures must and are only legislated in exceptional circumstances. Parliament recently passed the Property Practitioners Bill in 2019, now enacted, that clearly and constitutionally sets out in its explanatory memorandum the objectives to correct the deficiency of the old Estate Agency Affairs Act pertaining to search and entry powers. In the process of promulgating the Property Practitioners Bill, Parliament took careful measures to ensure the constitutionality of the search and entry measures and to ensure an equitable balance between the powers of the regulator and the recourse provided to the subject of such powers. Among other measures, the Bill provides for the right to appeal to a court. The provisions pertaining to search and entry as set out in Bill 2 of 2020 are not in keep with the search and entry procedures and right to recourse previously adopted by this Parliament. Deloitte has submitted a detailed table in Annex D to the submission of the comparisons between the laws on this topic, including the Tax Practitioners Act, the Financial Intelligence Centre Act, to name a few, which was deliberated extensively and during which process two senior counsel opinions were obtained. It is our strong recommendation that this bill adopts the provision set out in the Property Practitioners Act to ensure constitutionality and that this forms the blueprint on the topic. Honourable members, I thank you.
Thanks, Carla, from Deloitte. The next presentation will come from South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. You have got 15 minutes, Chartered Accountants.
Thank you, Chair. May I also ask the person who is sharing the presentation to share my presentation. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to add our voice to this important work of Parliament. We Before I proceed, Chair, I also want to add my voice to the passing of condolences to Professor Plaatje's family. I worked with Professor Plaatje when I worked at Treasury, and all our condolences to the family. Chair, we've submitted a detailed submission, so I'll talk to some of the provisions that we are responding to. But I want to start by saying that SAICA is indeed pleased that the process has restarted and the challenges that the pandemic posed and leading to some of the delays in dealing with this issue are now somewhat behind us and hopefully for good. So we welcome the bill and we support the initiative to strengthen the arm of ERBA. And all the points we're going to be making are points that are seeking to ensure that what is being done is indeed making ERBA an effective regulator. Please proceed go to the next. Private individual. And the issue here is that currently the legislation makes provisions in terms of who would not be accepted as a registered auditor, and largely it focuses on financial crime. Proceed to the next slide. This is in section 37, so section 3B. But our country faces another bigger problem, and the issue of ethics doesn't just with, and we believe that this issue has got to find expression in this legislation, and we are making amendments in our bylaws so that no person who is involved or accused and convicted of violent crimes becomes a member of SAICA. And we think the same should be, please proceed to the next slide. And if there was an option of a fine, then the regulatory board can look at that matter and decide whether the issue is of such a serious nature that you wouldn't be made to qualify. So we think that is an important issue, and SAICA, in line with this recommendation, is amending its bylaws to make sure that those people are not included. Next, please. Just next. Then there's two other issues that we want to just highlight. Already in the memorandum, Treasury does talk to the limited come with a regulation, you do need to think about the social economic impact of that regulation, and there is no evidence in this instance that such has been done. Next, please. So, and we are saying this because a parliamentary report does indicate the level of participation of our society in matters affecting parliament, and therefore the fact that you do have these open hearings does not necessarily translate in a broader stakeholdership being represented or able to raise its voice in these issues. And this is a report from Parliament that does point to this. And for that reason, we think, therefore, that the committee needs to consider. Please proceed to the next slide. The committee needs to consider the issue of public consultation that is already mentioned in the memorandum of the Treasury, whether that consultation requires the committee to take, to expand its people that it talks to, whether that necessitates that the committee in some areas as it happens, that consultation does undermine the process, or the committee can deal with some of those things. In as far as the social impact assessment, again, the committee may have to consider the recommendations that are being made here and whether these recommendations would necessitate such an assessment. And if so, the committee will take an appropriate decision in relation to that. We're just asking the committee to consider these issues. Next, please. Then there's an issue of referrals for non-audit issues where they can be referred to a professional body. While this is consistent in our view with the current Section 33 of the legislation, we also think that it is something that is not new. The tax dispensation already allows for a collaborative regulatory environment where the RBAs are able to work with SARS on certain matters, and SARS refers to some of those tax non-compliance issues by tax practitioners, the regulatory body, to the professional body to which the tax practitioners belong, and there is a process that is already indicated on how that can be done. So we think this is a welcome thing, but we also think that when the professional body has been given a matter by a regulator, therefore the professional body will have to deal with that using its prescripts, which is its constitution, its bylaws, and code of conduct, and therefore there has to be some kind of an agreement and an understanding between ERBA and the professional body in how that gets done. Next, please. Now, when the professional body deals with this matter, obviously it's going to have to deal with it in relation with its code of professional conduct. So when that has been done and dispensed with, it is important that there is no duplication of process. There is no second guessing between ERBA as well as the professional body, because then if that happens, a lot of time will have been lost and a lot of resources would be wasted in the process. And therefore, our recommendation in this regard is, can you proceed, please? In fact, just proceed to the next slide. So essentially, to avoid those duplications, the decision of the professional body would have to be binding on ERBA as well. So we need to be clear what is it that gets referred to the professional body, and include something that indicates that the professional body can only deal with that matter in relation to its prescripts. We have to put a mechanism that helps that the professional body is able to access the same kind of information that the regulator would be able to do. For instance, as SAICA, we cannot subpoena. So when a matter is referred, those concerns can be dealt with in the accreditation process between ERBA and the professional body. Next, please. The composition of the board. The composition of the board, we welcome and are happy that the issue of the participation of registered auditors is limited. But we are worried that as drafted today, it seems like there should be no registered auditor who's currently practicing. And that may weaken the regulator, because the regulator may then take decisions that actually a person who's currently practicing would be able to advise in terms of how relevant it is and all of those things. So we think at least one person should be an actually currently practicing a regulator. And of course, move on, please. So we think that one person should be there, and the one aspect in the composition of the board is the extension of the period, term period of the, at the expiry of the term of the board. We think instead of having that extension, 3 months isn't a lot of time in any event, there should be an, a compulsion on the minister to fill the vacancies in time rather than extending the period. But if the committee thinks extending the period does help, we think what would help more is the compulsion of the minister to deal with the appointment in time. After all, the appointment is every 2 years, and therefore there should be sufficient time to allow for the processes to take place. Next, please. So what we recommend here is that retain the 40% maximum of people with knowledge of the who have been participating in the registered audit space. Keep them in minority, but the balance between industry and independence has got to be maintained at all times so that the board is seen to be independent. Registered auditors don't, that do not do their test function, who are less of an independent, who have less of an independence concern and conflict are needed. But one registered auditor who's currently doing the work needs to be retained, and that is helpful. In fact, in the other areas, you do find that you keep that knowledge in place. The board chairperson may not be an auditor or registered auditor, and that is an important. And of course, we're suggesting that the minister should be compelled to fill the vacancy in time. Proceed, please. And the disciplinary committee. In this provision, what we see is that what seems to be seen as a disciplinary committee in the bill is a number of people from whom a certain number of people may be selected in order to oversee a particular case. And we see that as a panel as opposed to a disciplinary committee. So maybe the way that is defined may need to be adjusted as well. So if you think about it, you can have 10, 15 people that are appointed into a panel. And out of those people, there is a PPS matter or a sign-off matter, and then 3 people or 4 people, whatever the number is, get selected from the panel to oversee or hear a disciplinary matter, and that group of people should be referred to as a committee. Now, having said that, we're then going to talk about how we think the structure has got to work, but we suggest to the committee that that should be addressed so that there is no confusion in relation to this. So the disciplinary committee will hear the matter, but the panel will compose of individuals that would from which the committee would select. And then we're saying that that panel should be chaired by a retired judge or senior advocate at the very least. And the reason for this is because a retired judge already knows how to manage these processes and so on. And this is the person who would be responsible for selecting people that would be overseeing a particular matter and ensuring that the whole process as provided for in the bill is in fact efficient and runs smoothly. Next, please. So the role of the disciplinary committee obviously will be that of hearing the matter, which will be taken from the panel. We're saying that the reduction of the legal competence to any advocate or as far as the 10 years, it's a requirement for one member of the committee, but for the other 2 members, there is no specification of the qualifications, and we think it's important that something needs to be said in relation to that. And the appointment of the disciplinary panel, which is currently referred to as a committee, the appointment of the disciplinary panel has to be an independent process. That process should be done by a party other than ERBA to ensure that the regulator is in fact independent of this. And of course, there is an issue of the three-year term that is suggested. We think that will undermine and weaken the whole effectiveness of the regulatory process, because some of the matters that would have to be dealt with are complex. They're going to run over a long period of time. And for that reason, you therefore need to have a longer term that is non-renewable to ensure that also people do not end up trying to do things in order to please those that appoint them into continuing into term. So you could then address the issues of independence that way. Next, please. So our recommendation is that we retain the requirement that the chairperson of the disciplinary committee, which is the panel in terms of the way we see it, is the person who ensures the effectiveness of the overall process, and this person still remains to be a retired judge or a senior advocate. That's the first recommendation. We're saying let's prescribe the minimum competence for the two-thirds of the non-auditors in the committee, so that again we've got the knowledge and experience that is needed to execute this important task effectively. Create an independence and reduce the perception of bias in the of the people into the panel. They could be appointed by the president or the minister, but a structure other than the, and already the Auditor General, the Public Protector, and other structures in the tech space are being appointed on this basis. And we think that will then create of independence and remove the perception of bias on the people that are sitting in the disciplinary panel that will ultimately be selected into the disciplinary committee. And then the last piece is about the independence of these people. We're saying instead of making it a three-year term, renewable, rather have a 7 or 10 year, but 7 year single fixed term that is non-renewable. A person serves for that period and that period only. But we also recognize that at the end of the 7 years, one or more of the members of the committee may be adjudicating a matter that is complex, that has not been concluded at the date when their term is expiring. And therefore, we suggest that those people's term, only to the extent that there's a matter outstanding that they are dealing with, gets extended until the conclusion of that matter. But they don't get given any new matter at that time. They deal with the matter that is already that they are already dealing with. As an additional, to make sure that this doesn't become a thing that happens regularly, we then say in the last 6 months of the term of all the people that are in the panel, they shall not be given new cases. But also the appointment of people into the panel must be staggered to allow for the terms, not all of the terms, to expire at the same time, because it will create a crisis for the regulator as well. Next, please. And then there's the issue of search and seizure that a number of commentators have spoken to already. And our view as SAICA is that, one, there is a reason why ERBA wants to have these powers. In the current legislation, although limited in character, limited to disciplinary hearing matters. Hello?
Proceed, Mr. Nomvalo. You are left with 2 minutes. I've extended your time.
Yeah, so in relation to this matter, Chair, we're saying that what is being proposed should be considered in relation to the Constitution. Already there is a provision that allows ERBA that makes it an offense not to cooperate with ERBA. We don't know of any case that is pending or case that has been, any person that has been charged as a result of that, but we understand the need for powers that enable ERBA to have access to information in order to do its regulation effectively. What we are then proposing is that we should, can you move to the next slide, please? The next slide. Yeah, what we're proposing is this, that in order for this part of the regulation not to make the regulator weak and ineffective, there are already a number of pieces of legislation that where these powers have been included, and we've included an analysis in our submission of those legislations. And some of them have been challenged in court, and they've been found wanting in relation to the constitution. So we are saying we should not, having learned those lessons, have a provision that can be challenged constitutionally successfully. So let's learn from those constitutional court decisions. Let's then put an amendment, an adjustment into this provision that enables ERPA to have these powers, but these powers can be effective. And of course, there needs to be a balance in relation to the rights of other individuals as enshrined in the constitution as well. Next, please. Chair, the rest of the issues are minor technical recommendations that are covered in our submission. I'm not going to talk to that. But overall, SAICA supports the legislation, but also SAICA believes that when we make these recommendations, the reason is to make the regulator more effective, and therefore we should not put in provisions that we can already identify, because there's precedent that those regulations can be defeated in a court of law, because that weakens the regulator. And let's learn from that and adjust the provisions accordingly. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Freeman Omvalo from SAICA. The next presenter is Bernard Agalas. Bernard, how are you?
Fine, Jay, and yourself?
Where are you now? You are the one who started this trouble. Now you are independent. good to see you.
Same here, Jay, and I'm sorry we couldn't continue working together, but at least I still have the opportunity to engage with you on this forum. Good morning again, Chair and members and stakeholders, and thank you for the opportunity. Let me start off by saying that I fully support the amendments to the Auditing Profession Act, and I will do my presentation in three parts. First of all, as per my comment letter, I will sketch the context in which these amendments are being proposed. I also want to touch briefly on what a competent regulator should be able to do, and then I will get to my specific comments. So firstly, we must always bear in mind that these amendments are in response to ensuring that we continue to protect the public and that we prevent losses to the public and to pensioners and investors. And of course, that has to be the primary objective of the legislator. These amendments are also in response to the criticism that we've seen against the auditing profession as well as against the audit regulator. And the specific, you can go to the next slide. And the specific areas where there has been criticism has been on the front of the level of the sanctions. The fact that the regulator didn't have insufficient enforcement powers, as well as the length of time that the regulator takes to complete these investigations. And we all know that this length of time is impacted on by the capacity and the resources of the regulator. The second contextual influence on why these amendments have become important is that we need to look at the current environment. And I'm not going to go into detail of the reputational crisis. We're all very familiar with that. But we also know that there are many root causes, including the behavior of auditors, which again includes behavior such as a lack of independence. And therefore, the amendments to the Audit Profession Act is really part of a bigger strategy to restore confidence in the profession. Also not going to go into the detail of the recent audit failures, but we do have to recognize that it is not business as usual. And whatever amendments are proposed is in response to the current environment in which the country finds itself, and specifically the protection that needs to be given to investors which rely on the services of auditors. This this opportunity to look at the auditors again, and auditors coming under the spotlight, has also reminded us that it's not only the auditors that participate in the financial reporting ecosystem, but that there are many other stakeholders and role players. And we also should not forget that they all have responsibilities and play a part in having a credible and reliable financial reporting system and financial markets for the country. But also, we need to look at the consequences, not only for auditors, as we will in current amendments, but we also need to look at consequences for those other stakeholders. I'll come back to that in my specific comments. And I refer to the technical and behavioral competencies. I'm referring to the board in this case, because there are provisions about the independence of the board. Let us not forget that it's not only important for the governing structure to be independent of those that they regulate, but that there must also be no conflicts of interest when it comes to those board members, and that they should always act in the best interest of the IRBA and in the best interest of the public, and not specific individuals or act for a purpose that doesn't come back to what will serve the public. If I can then, after having sketched that context, move on to what I believe a competent regulator should encompass. Next slide, please. To be able to protect the public, it's important that, and I'm sketching this these requirements because that will inform my comments, my specific comments. So firstly, it's important that regulators must have adequate powers and resources, and competent powers and resources, not only human resources, but also financial resources. And when we look at the financial investment that is required in our regulators, it is far less than the billions that we lose every year because of inability to have a competent regulator. In the years that the World Economic Forum still ranked South Africa number one for its auditing standards, it also ranked South Africa very highly for the strength of its institutions, for its legislation, and for its good anti-corruption measures. But it's important that those institutions are then capacitated to be able to deliver on their responsibilities. When you have adequate powers and resources, this will lead to efficient processes. Certainly, if there's no justice immediately or as soon as possible, then it will be justice denied not only to the auditors, but also, more importantly, to the public. It's important that any regulator has the power to yield appropriate sanctions. And although we don't want sanctions to inform how professional people behave, it will act as a deterrent if sanctions are at the right level. We've heard before from the other stakeholders that the processes must be fair, and it must be fair to not only the auditors, but importantly, it has to also be fair to the public. And I think that the recent failures that we've seen and the losses that we've seen suffered by pensioners and investors, we have to ask ourselves whether the current legislation has been fair to the public and to investors. When it comes to regulators, their governance structures have to be independent, and as I mentioned, not only from those that they regulate, but it also has to be free of any conflict of interest and must always act in the best interest of the mandate of that organization. In the case of the RBA, it is protect the public. And what we've also seen from these recent audit and business failures is that it's not only one of the role players being the auditors that contributed towards these failures, but that there are other role players in the financial reporting chain, including the boards of companies, the audit committees of companies, and other staff with governance, the internal auditors. And there has to be a comprehensive approach to respond to correcting and strengthening the entire financial reporting ecosystem, and not only focus on audit. And lastly, in order for a regulator to be competent, it has been relevant, it has to be responsive, and it can only be responsive as adequate powers. If I can then move to the next slide and specific comments. Firstly, regarding the powers of the regulator, as I mentioned, a regulator has to be empowered and capacitated. And to do so, evidence must be readily available to that regulator. Of course, a body like the RVA will exercise such powers to obtain evidence with the utmost discretion, and it should only probably be used where there is no cooperation. If there is nothing to hide from the auditors, then surely the regulator should be allowed to have access to the information and to all the documents it requires to prove its case, and similarly, the auditor will have the opportunity to prove their side. In respect to the disciplinary process, again, emphasize that the process has to be fair to all parties, but it's also important that the current unnecessary steps in the disciplinary process needs to be removed. We must remember that audit is a public interest function, and auditors must deliver and is expected to deliver on their technical and ethical responsibilities in a professional manner. Now, I say that because when it comes to the disciplinary process, it's important that auditors can follow a legal process to protect their rights. But the legal process should not be followed to respond to technical and professional and ethical matters. Therefore, the process must be driven by technical and ethical considerations and supported by a legal process, not the other way around. When it comes to the magnitude of the sanctions, next slide, please. We've heard this morning that it's important that the amount of the sanction must be appropriate to the offence being committed. If the amounts are too low, then it's not going to prevent that offence being committed, and therefore it must at least be appropriate in amount to the nature of the offence. And then it's also important that, like other jurisdictions, the RBA consider non-monetary sanctions, which I think it already does. That is also a way to respond to addressing misconduct. And my final comments are just to remind the members that we must address failures in the financial reporting ecosystem from a more broader, wider perspective. And when we look at an audit failure or a business failure, it's a failure actually in the broader ecosystem. And therefore, we must also in future consider how legislation can address any failures in the broader ecosystem. And therefore, we would like the legislature to continue to consider a process of comprehensive regulation which will level the playing fields and ensure that everybody in the financial reporting chain is held to account. But for now, I fully support strengthening the oversight of the RBA over the auditors and thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks very much, Bernard, for your presentation, and good to see you again. And then the next stakeholder is Mr. Dumisani Mahlangu. Over to you, sir. You have got 15 minutes. So it's from now until 11 o'clock. Mr. Mahlangu, are you there? I saw you earlier on. Alan and Tebu, can we get hold of Mr. Mahlangu? I saw him earlier on when his colleagues were presenting.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I was on mute.
No, okay. No. We are in the fourth industrial revolution. We must get used.
it's so embarrassing that I am so young, yet it seems that I am not caught up with the times, Mr. Chair.
Okay, you have got 15 minutes, so it's from now until 11 o'clock.
Okay, cool. I was saying thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members of parliament. My name is Dumisani Mahlangu, and I am just somebody who is interested in the assurance, governance, and the accountancy profession, and how access is enabled in this sector and the transformative imperatives therein. I would really like to thank you and the entire members of the Sixth Parliament that you can enable me and people like myself to be able to become active citizens and be able to exercise such an important democratic right. Mr. Chair, let me just comment on the bill. In the main, honorable members, I welcome the bill, and I do hope that it will achieve its intended objectives, with the exception of one or two reservations that I have. But then I also have raised a proposal on that submission. Honorable members, Bernard Agalaf has alluded to the need for comprehensive regulation in the entire financial reporting value chain. And that I would like to spend this moment to expand on the need for comprehensive regulation. I want to spend time to giving you why is it necessary for comprehensive regulation in this space. And I'm of the view that this bill needs to be expanded. It needs to be expanded to enable it to give rise to a regulatory board that can be a comprehensive regulator. I am aware that this bill only covers the audit profession. However, the audit profession does not exist in isolation, but is dependent on other services such as the accountancy profession, other profession in other assurance services, and the governance profession. However, it is my view, members, that in order to ensure that the regulatory oversight is strong and effective, it cannot be that whilst the audit profession operates together with other domains within the financial reporting and assurance value chain, it is the only profession that is being regulated. The accountancy profession, for example, those who prepare financial statements, other assurance providers, example, internal auditors who sometimes assure these financial reports, and those who play an oversight role over this report, that is the audit committee members, as an example, requires a legislative framework that will have oversight over their work, like the audit profession does. It is for this reason, therefore, Mr. Chair, that I propose that this committee consider expanding this bill to include the regulation over the accountancy profession, other assurance and non-assurance services that are relevant, and those who play an oversight role by virtue of their work in the governance role. And I believe that this is an opportune moment to do so. I just want to focus on one aspect of my submission, that is of comprehensive regulation. Bennett has alluded to it, but I just want to delve deeper in that. And I want to demonstrate to you why is it important for comprehensive regulation, and then why do I propose that IRBA in its current form should be disbanded in order to pave the way for an entity that will be a board that is comprehensive in its regulation. Why is comprehensive regulation necessary? Mr. Chair and honorable members, in my view, comprehensive regulation is necessary to effect greater accountability. As it stands, only external auditors are regulated, but other parties in the sector are not. That prevents accountability and possible consequence for those who might have knowingly misled auditors or willfully perpetrated fraud in the financials or any other assurance report to be left alone. Or even those who might have purposefully turned a blind eye on their oversight role, which they are expected to exercise. Mr. Chair, let me just delve you deeper into the vision of IRBA. The vision of IRBA reads as follows. The IRBA is evolving to be an internationally recognized regulator of the audit profession and other assurance services relevant to the South African environment. However, Mr. Chair, IRBA also have a strategic pillar, and one of its strategic pillars is comprehensive regulation. Mr. Chair, let's perhaps pay attention to other assurance services. As it stands, honorable members, as much as IRBA harbor this type of aspiration, it does so without a regulatory framework conducive for it to realize such ideals. It is therefore necessary that this bill is drafted in such a way that it allows the regulation, not only of the audit profession, but also the accountancy profession, profession of other assurance service and governance practitioners and the bodies to which they belong. Just to give a proper example to members, let's assume that one of our big state-owned entities that is listed in the Schedule 2 of the PFMA has a functioning audit department, has a competent internal auditor, and then let's say what they do is that according to their internal audit plan, they are required to do tender compliance. They do tender compliance, and then they observe some weaknesses in that space. What it means is that often at times the recommendations of internal auditors are ignored. But then if they identify that there has been a material non-compliance in the work that executives have performed, internal auditors, if their recommendations are being ignored, they are not going to be able to refer these matters to any other professional body or entity of the government, as is the case with external auditors that can report reportable irregularities to IRBA, or the Auditor General that can refer material irregularities wherever relevant. So it is for this reason that people like assurance professionals like internal auditors also need to be regulated so that they can too have a legislative framework in which their work can be referred to an entity like IRBA to conduct investigation. So I'm of the view, Mr. Chair, that if the bill under discussion can incorporate comprehensive regulation, then greater accountability within the profession will be enabled and the regulatory oversight will be strengthened, as envisaged by the Minister of Finance in his budget speech earlier this year. Let me further mention two recommendations observed in the 2013 World Bank report on the observance of standards and codes. And that report recommends that, one, South Africa should enact appropriate legislation to provide for the regulation of both professional accountancy organizations as an audit regulatory body. And then one other recommendation that they've made is that IRBA resources and capacity should be increased and funding model should be stabilized. The first recommendation speaks to a need for a regulatory framework in which comprehensive regulation will be possible. And the second one speaks to the need to adequately fund IRBA and capacitate it in terms of its human capital. Mr. Chair, it will not help any of us if Parliament can enact this legislation, but IRBA is inadequately funded. The economic life cycle of this country, the confidence of investors, and the reputation of the accountancy, auditing, and other related assurance professions require a board that is comprehensive in its regulation. Mr. Chair and members of the Standing Committee on Finance, one other thing that must concern members is the dwindling numbers of registered auditors. But it is only IRBA that can answer to this committee as to how it plans to increase the number of registered auditors and making auditing profession attractive to young people. As it stands, there's about 3,800 registered auditors. Effectively, we are discussing a bill that serves a limited interest group. We are providing a legislative environment to a profession that is inaccessible, with barriers that are artificial, and that a profession is still largely untransformed. And Mr. Chair, I don't know how I feel about that, but then it's really not a good feeling. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, as South Africa, as interested members of the profession, Are we ready for an audit reform? Mr. Chair, borrowing from the examples in the United Kingdom, you would have seen that there are reforms into the audit profession in that country, whereby the effectiveness and quality of audits was looked into. Separating consulting business from audit business in Big Four firms was proposed, and really how the audit expectation gap can be narrowed if not closed altogether. Are we as a country ready to look into this type of audit reforms? My position is I do not think so. Until such a time there is a legislative framework giving a fertile ground for comprehensive regulation, and have seen the extent of the effectiveness of that legislation. But for now, we need a legislation that will enable comprehensive regulation, and once that is enacted, perhaps we can start talking about audit reform. Maloko a parliamentary tlotlegileng, amalungu esemthetho ahloniphekileko, honorable members of parliament, njengalo nalele maloka committee ekhethehileng yamatlotlo, ngithokoza kwamambala, ke leboga go menagane. Thank you very much and nkosi kakhulu.
Siyathokoza Mahlangu for your presentation. Okay. Madam Teboh, are we done with the submissions? We seem now to be moving towards the deliberations, or do we still have more stakeholders?
No, that was the last one, Chair.
Okay. Okay. Members, those were the submissions from members of the public. Now it's our time to ask questions for clarity and make comments. Do we have officials from Treasury and ERBA in the platform? Teboh and Alan.
Hi, it's Alan. MP van Skoor, Advocate MP van Skoor is here to represent National Treasury. I'm not sure if there's anybody from ERBA online.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we Janita John from ERBA, and we've got our chairman as well, Marty Janssen van Rensburg, on the Zoom session as well, together with our other members of the team. Thank you.
Okay. Alan, you'll assist me in identifying members who would like to ask questions and make comments.
Chair, for now, it's Dr. George that's raised his hand.
Dr. George, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentations. I don't have any specific questions. The presentations are very clear. I do want to say, however, that the audit profession has let South Africa down very badly, and they must be held to account in a much better way. So hopefully this legislation will head us in that direction. It does seem clear from what has happened in the country and how the auditors have facilitated state capture and really various other financial crimes, is that the audit profession is not able to hold itself properly to account. And therefore, the regulator has to do that for them. And ERBA has not done a job well in that regard. So hopefully, their arm will be strengthened and they will be able to perform the role better to hold the auditors to account who have actually been facilitators of the people's money getting stolen. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Do we have other members who would like to make contributions?
Okay.
Honorable Abdul, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Thanks so much, Teboho. Yeah, I wish to really thank the people who have submitted comments. And it really enhances public participation. And I'm happy that Commissioner Freeman also mentioned the strengthening of public participation. But when you listen to the presentations that have been submitted, you listen with interest as to how sometimes contradicting contributions are made. I'm sorry, Bernard, for example, your friend, Alagas, talks to issues of unnecessary proceedings that need to be removed, while Deloitte submits that all processes should be contained in the Act. Now, that makes for interesting listening. And maybe, Chair, just starting with the contributions that were made by COSATU and the reference to the reduction of meetings from four to two. I think Matthew will also agree with me that, you know, sometimes meetings are put there just as legislation or regulation, but, you know, sometimes they are not there to really fulfill a need per se, but they merely serve for compliance. And if two meetings can do the task that has been set for four meetings, then I think that should not be changed, unless the number of meetings is not sufficient to do the work that is prescribed for the board. The next area I think that seems to be important for COSATU is the seasonal operation times. And I think on this one, I agree with them, because indeed what they put forward, that you cannot have criminals dictating to you as to when and how you should search me when I have erred against the law. Sorry. And therefore it shouldn't be that there should be time stipulated for seizure operations to take place. And I think I also agree with them on the issue of the rotation of auditing firms, so that they don't get used and at the end of the day form unwarranted relations with the organizations that they are supposed to audit. That's it for me for COSATU. But Open Secrets talks to issues of appointing the board and dealing with allegations of impropriety that needs to be investigated, and that having to be mandatory and findings published. I think it's a general norm in the human resource of government institutions that for new appointments, especially at that level, it is mandatory, unless there's a gap. Maybe Treasury should help us there, but it is mandatory for investigations to take place to ensure that people appointed at those levels are fit to work at that level, and there are no question marks against their name. When it comes to the Ernst & Young, and again, my view on the contradictions between the presenters come up again when Ernst & Young talks to the issues of the warrant for contravention of the Act, which needs to be balanced and fair. I think the concept of balanced and fair runs through the presentation of Ernst & Young, which is of course understandable, because they themselves are a firm of auditors. However, without saying, my view is that without saying, when a crime or criminals are tested in a court of law, there's always balance and fairness, you know. So I wasn't sure if they can maybe comment more on that. When it comes to Deloitte, there's the issue of a regular oversight of auditors' function and duties of all committees. Now, Deloitte and Touche talk to the constitution of the board, and I think now at this time there's guidance from SAICA as to how, because I was going to ask a question from Deloitte as to when they say that it should be registered auditors, I was going to ask a question as to whether the board should be constituted of all auditors or some auditors, but I think SAICA responds to that through the 40% representation that they talk to. And Chair, on the overall, I think one is happy that in spite of the issues that have been raised, there's general support for the amendment bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Abram. Are there other members, who will want to make comments and ask questions?
Those were the only two, Chairperson.
Okay. Let me also make a comment or there is an issue raised by SAICA that a board chairperson may not be an auditor. Is it going to be workable that somebody who has got no background of the auditing profession be eligible to chair a body that specifically regulates auditors? What skills should that person have? And I'm not sure whether it applies to other regulatory bodies. Say it's a regulatory body for town planners. You don't have a background of town planning, town and regional planning.
In terms of the current legislation as well as...
Wait. We don't do things in that manner. We first ask questions, then we'll invite you to respond. That's an issue that I would like to get clarity. And probably to National Treasurer and ERBA, there is an issue that is raised consistently of the right to appeal. Deloitte have raised that issue, and I think also SAICA have also raised the same issue. Is it provided for in the bill that there should be no right to appeal? Because if so, it will be in contradiction with the Constitution, Section 34, which allows anybody to have a right of access to the courts. And then the other issue that has been raised consistently is the seizure. What do we call it? Yes. As a measure of search of premises and warrants. What I hear Bernard to be saying is that it should be a situation where there is no cooperation, and it's also raised by SAICA and other stakeholders. But there is an issue raised very sharply by Mr. Masango, who said that the profession remain untransformed and seem to be not attractive to young people, as he himself is a young person. It's a matter that Treasury will have to respond to as to what is its attitude in regard to the transformation of the auditing profession. Over to you, stakeholders and Treasury and ERBA. Alan and Tebuko, you will assist me with the stakeholders or ERBA and Treasury as to if ever they are raising their hands, because sometimes I can't see them from my screen this side, to respond to the questions that have been raised.
I think for now it's only Mr. Nomvalo who wants to respond.
Okay, but the Treasury and ERBA will have to respond to some of the issues here, just to give clarity. Mr. Nomvalo, over to you from SAIC.
Thank you, Chair, and apologies for jumping in too early. So, Chair, on the issue of the board.
I can hear Mr. Nomvalo from my side. Can you hear him from your side, Tebogen Alan?
No, I can't hear him, sir. I'm not sure what's happening with this connection.
Mr. Nomvalo, you are muted.
Enhance that if the chairperson of the board.
Mr. Nomvalo, yes. There seem to be a problem with the audio. We can see you, the video is 100% visible, but the voice sometimes just disappears. I don't know whether your machine sometime in between mutes itself.
It would seem so, Chair, because I can see it's not muted and I'm not touching anything on the desktop to avoid accidentally muting. But can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you. Can you go back to where you started on clarifying the question that you are responding to?
Thank you, Chair. So I'm saying, Chair, the current board, the current provision. Of the board. So I think because you will have some people with the knowledge of auditing, as well as we're proposing one registered auditor who's currently practicing, there will be that input in the decisions, but we don't think that a person who's not an auditor may not be able to chair the board. You need a different types of skills in that space as opposed to the auditing skills, to the extent that that person will need those skills. The board will have, as the legislation prescribes, some people within the board that have knowledge of the auditing profession who will then help the chairperson in thinking through some of the technical issues that might arise. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Nomvalo. Are there other stakeholders from your side, Tebukhanale, who would like to
Matthew Parks and Janita John, and Ms. Kyla Brudix.
So there's Parks from Cosato. Who's the next one? So that I have to know.
Janita Jones and Kyla Brudix.
Janita Jones and then Kyla. Broodrix.
Yes.
Okay. Comrade Matthews, over to you.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chair. I think just a few quick comments and responses. I think to Honourable George Chair, I would agree with him 100%. Failed the country, and it has failed the state and the SOEs with regards to its role during the era of state capture. So this bill is critical to deal with it. And of course, auditors can't regulate themselves. And we think that the bill will take us a step forward towards strengthening Urba, which is critical. To Honorable Whip Comrade Abram, the issue of rotation is that, yes, we know there can be malicious compliance. It's whether you have 4 meetings or 2 meetings in itself doesn't guarantee quality of governance. But the fact is that if you're going to reduce from 4 to 2, 2 is a very small negligible amount. It might mean you meet once in 6 months, or you may have 2 meetings in January and be done for the year. And given the amount of oversight, the amount of cleaning up the state, the amount of work, we fear reducing the required meetings to 2 is opening a dangerous can of worms. In fact, they'll need to have many more meetings. So we think that it's just an unnecessary risk, Chair. Chair, we agree with Comrade Abrams that putting Urba with when it can do search and seizure operations. And I think for us, Chair, it's also critical that the mandatory rotation of firms must be put in the bill. It shouldn't be left to Urba to do it as it seeks fit, because you can find a new board can come into office one day and be captured. And then they can then take back some of the work that the previous board has done, which is quite useful. Chair, around the board composition, we are comfortable with the board's wording, the bill's wording, that it shouldn't be practicing auditors, because there is an inherent conflict of interest when you want to regulate yourself. I know there were some comments about balance between search and seizure and privacy. Chair, we're in an abnormal context of industrial scale capture or corruption, and the auditors played a key role. So we think we need to err on the side of dealing with corruption, not err on the side of privacy. All rights have a limitation, Chair. I think there was a very useful input by Open Secrets, where it talked about the need for fines to be proportional to the amount of damage done to the state, which often is in the billions of rands. I think that's a very useful input. We would want to see sanctions really being strong and as much of a deterrent as possible. I think lastly, Chair, we think there has been sufficient public consultation. This bill, as colleagues might remember, was before Parliament, before the last elections. Space was given for more consultation. It's now come back again. And of course, the department had its own consultation process. We're having the second round of hearings in the NA now. And of course, the NCP would also have its own processes. We can't over-consult when we have to deal with capacity in the state and arresting the scourge of corruption, Chair. But I think lastly, Chair, I'm just a little bit worried about some of the content, and I respect people's rights to different views, but we're dealing with the area of state capture. It's problematic for the industry to say the laws are too strict. We can't be too strict when we're dealing with corruption, Chairperson. So I think the auditing sector really needs to look, have a deep introspection, what is the role they played? And we need to support the state and deal with corruption and state capture. We can't water down the provisions. In fact, if anything, Comrade Chair, to conclude, we must actually strengthen the provisions. But watering it down is just tantamount to saying corruption is okay, let's continue business as usual. But thank you, Comrade Chair and members.
Thanks, Comrade Matthew. Ms. Janita Jones, over to you from Urba.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity. And what I would like to say upfront is that, you know, we really appreciate all of the constructive comments that have come through. And we've heard you, we've heard the discussion thus far, and we take all of this into our ear, and we will be deliberating on these matters. We will further engage and we will further consult with all stakeholders that have provided input today. I will let MP answer the question on the right to appeal. She will respond on that. The one I take note of specifically is the item raised by Mr. Mashlangu on the dwindling numbers on the registry as well as the lack of transformation. I would like to make an announcement that we have just completed a process where we're trying to recreate the appeal of the registered auditor, the brand itself. And we must remember that it's not just the Urba that plays in this value chain. It starts right from tertiary level through to SAICA, through to the audit firms, and finally lands into Urba as the custodian of the registered auditor. So we have developed an initiative, which we will be implementing soon, on recreating that appeal and making sure we attract people back onto the registry itself. The lack of transformation is noted. Yes, it's an area that's been underscored for quite a while now. We've had the CA charter in place. We are busy reviewing what we call the audit profession code, and we will be hopefully finalizing that quite soon from a transformation profession of the profession across, again, the value chain, taking into account the various stakeholders that would ultimately contribute to creating the pipeline of competent registered auditors onto the registry itself. Thank you once again, Mr. Chairman, and we will further deliberate and respond on all issues that have been raised at this session.
Thanks, Ms. Janita Jones. Didn't you request somebody or your colleague to clarify a question or a comment?
Yes, that was National Treasury on the aspect relating, and that's MP. MP is on now. Thank you.
National Treasurer, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honourable members of the committee. Just to explain, as you alluded to Section 34 of the Constitution, any decision made in terms of the Act, there will be access to the court, so that's not prohibited in the current Act or in the proposed amendments. But my understanding is that the stakeholders are proposing a type of an internal appeal. So when we respond to all the submissions, we will also deal with that aspect at a later stage when the committee schedules the meeting. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Alan and Teboho, do we still have other stakeholders who want to make a contribution?
Chairs, just the Carla Budrix, and then I see there's Michael Marchant also raised his hand from Open Secrets.
Okay, Michael, over to you, Open Secrets. Before Michael, Carla Budrix, I noted her before you. Ms. Carla Budrix from Deloitte, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I raised my hand before the state law advisor spoke, but we would welcome engagement on the aspect of appeal. We've sent some research on the aspect, and if we look at other pieces of legislation, such as the Financial Sector Regulation Act, the Financial Intelligence Center Act, the Tax Administration Act, the Health Professions Act, Engineering Professions Act and so forth, Legal Practices Act, and then the recently deliberated Property Practitioners Bill, they all include an appeal process, either to a court of law or to a tribunal, and we would be happy to engage on those aspects. The aim of it is to bring constitutional balance into the law. Just on the topic of registered auditors, the other question that was asked by one of the honourable members, on the representation of auditors on the board, we propose that the 40% registered audit composition be retained. If there's a worry about independence, there's a possibility for the non-attest or non-assurance auditors, as they refer to, who are not signing off on audits, there's a possibility of looking at that to bring in the balance with independence. Just on the issue of comprehensive regulation, just to maybe just speak to that specific question or some of the remarks that were made by the honourable members. We fully support a comprehensive regulatory framework. We were hoping that the APA amendments are just one step in a broader regulatory framework where we look at all the role players in the financial reporting ecosystem, and we're also happy to engage on that specific topic. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Carla Budrix. Michael, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I just have a few comments to make. which I just want to address some of the questions that have been raised specifically to us, but also some of the points that have been made by other stakeholders and their contributions. The first one is just to reiterate the point that we've made around the IRBA board and the importance of keeping that independent. And we would agree with the point that I think was made from Mr. Nombalo from SAICA, that the presence, for example, of a retired auditor, of someone that, and of that nature, can bring in technical expertise in other spaces without having an actively registered auditor in a position such as the chairperson. We'd reiterate the evidence that we've provided to the committee, and this is from around the world, that one of the fundamental blockages in audit reform and audit regulation around the world are conflicts of interest. And to return to the member's question around our point about the appointment process, I think we would still maintain that it's important to have an explicit reference in the Act that demands that the minister considers conflicts of interest when appointing people to the board, particularly if the committee does start to reconsider the question around the 40% presence of auditors on the board. It is deeply dangerous to the process to have people who may have been working with in various ways and forms, the people that they're then required to make regulatory decisions about very soon after that. And so I think this point really needs to be very carefully considered to ensure the independence of the board remains. A brief point just to reiterate the question of fines, which is I think we quite strongly disagree with proposals from the industry to start placing maximum levels on fines to the industry. Just as a point of comparison, currently the current requirement is limit is 200,000 rand for a fine, which is wholly inadequate. To give you an example of a fine that was just placed on Deloitte in the United Kingdom for a failed audit of a company that was then bought by Hewlett-Packard. That fine was £15 million, which is over 300 million rand for the audit firm Deloitte itself. And then the audit partners individually were fined 250 and 500,000 pounds and were suspended from practice. And I think that it's the recognition in jurisdictions such as the United Kingdom that if you're really going to deter the very worst kind of conduct, you need to allow the regulator the space to impose very strict fines that will actually be a deterrent on honestly what have become unbelievably powerful and wealthy companies, corporations. And so I think going down the route of any maximum level would be incredibly dangerous. And then two final points, and I'll be very brief, which is just to reiterate that some of the stakeholders mentioned this word, which is the expectations gap, which is something that comes up in talk about auditors all the time, which is this notion that the legislation is trying to fix an expectation gap of what the public expects and what auditing can deliver. What we've said in our written submission is that really what we should, and I think this reiterates Kosatu's point, is there's not an expectations gap, there's currently an accountability gap. Because what the public expects of audit firms is not an unrealistic expectation. Rather, it's a legitimate expectation of demanding financial propriety and that they're falling short of that. And so this act is not to bridge a difference in expectations, but it's to demand the industry aligns its conduct with what I think are legitimate demands from the public. And then finally, to return to the last question from one of the members around disclosure in the public interest, we just reiterate that in a number of places in the Act, when it comes to, for example, distributing the findings of a decision, explaining why a disciplinary process is being held behind doors, or, for example, disclosing information that you come across in your function in terms of the Act, we think that in all of those sections, there should be explicit inclusion of a provision for disclosure in the public interest, and that all decisions of IRBA should be made public and where not adequate reasons should be given. And we do firmly believe that this is a constitutional imperative in terms of Section 32. So thank you again.
Thanks, Michael. Alan and Tebogo, do we have members who want to ask questions or make follow-up?
No, we don't have any, Chair.
Okay. If not, we'll have to move towards the conclusion. In regard to the process from here, now that we have received public submissions, the department will respond to the submissions from the public on the 10th of November. From there, the committee will have a meeting to deliberate on the report and vote on the report on the 17th of November. So that's the process from here moving forward. From there, we'll submit the report to the speaker to be tabled in the National Assembly. Then the speaker will indicate as to when will be the plenary for us to present the report. I see the statement from Treasury. I'm not sure if members have seen that. The minister has written to the speaker to request a change of date in regard to the tabling of the MTBPS. Initially, the MTBPS was supposed to be tabled next week. I think, is it the 21st? Then now the minister has requested the speaker to shift the date to the 28th of October. And this might have an impact on our program. He has given reasons why he can't present or table the MTBPS next week. So I have to indicate to members right away that it will seriously affect our program. So we'll see as to how do we adjust our program in the light of the change of date in regard to the tabling of the MTBPS. Do we have announcements from Secretariat before we close?
Not at this stage. The next meeting would be next Tuesday.
Okay. Thanks very much, honorable members, for participating in this meeting. Thanks to the stakeholders, members of the public for your submissions. Thanks to Treasury, ERBA, and parliamentary officials. The meeting is adjourned.